And we were able to use that as a basis for some of our research. And then to have a physicist to mm-hmm. guide you, mathematician to do the other things, you know.
And that was Britt, was it?
Britt and Hoppe and Pfeiffer, who was a physicist, a teacher mm-hmm. of physics in the University of Berlin for quite a while. And he got to working on this system.
Would you mind backtracking a bit about when you found it and how you found it? And
this?
Because this was
part of our experiment proof after Professor Britt turned this information. He knew he was going to die, see, which he did a very few years ago. And same way with Pfeiffer, and also with Professor Hoppe. And because we have known them ever since they come to Alaska, and I was kind of the head of the family here, all the rest of them, you know, going various areas, why they still come to our house any time they were in town. And right up until the time he went to a pioneer's home in Sitka, I was still taking lessons at least once a week. And for the last 6 months before he left, it was every day, whether I was so tired and half asleep or not.
When was that? About how many years ago?
In the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I still had to make a living. And other things that I committed to do. And mainly family and other interests, you know, land and all that sort of thing, mines. So you can't devote all your time to this, which I should have done.
Well, you couldn't.
I should have. I've had opportunities, you know, but it would change. It would change your situation. It would change your family type life.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, family is the most, I'm going to tell you a story about that too. Family is the most important thing that we have here on earth.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And, but for that reason, why procrastinate? But if you were going to do it right, why you do like ordinary scientists, you go to school and learn what other people think that is right, and then branch out on your own and keep continuously exploring.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have somebody else to foot the bill for that. You can't do it on your own. But you probably are familiar. Same way with art.
Same way with art.
You've got, you're limited in the amount of time that you can devote, and you can't go out and ballyhoo this.
No.
If you do, why, then you're no different than with Cap Lathrop boosting up Sidney Lawrence's paintings and so forth. So, in 1952, when this episode out here occurred,
you had discovered it through the two bits.
Well, I was on that road, and I'd parked a little ways from
mm-hmm.
there. First of all, here's these trees growing up. You
mm-hmm.
couldn't tell there's a road there
mm-hmm.
because the delicate tundra was disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
But away from that road, you're mm-hmm. continually having to cut brush and stuff because things grow.
Mm-hmm.
You've disturbed it. But a little ways from there, why, everything is just like it was many, many years ago. Out a little further from there, a little ways further from where we've cleared off there, mm-hmm. you can see over the brush just like you did before.
200 years ago.
Now, do you want that, or do you want some new trees? We get all our wood right here that we need. We don't have to
mm-hmm.
go out of our little acreage.
That's good.
And
yeah.
My God, it's important.
Sure is.
And moose food and all that
mm-hmm.
sort of thing. So as a result, we used that anyway for developing it. Since 1972, I've been devoting most of my time to that. And you still have to do other things, you know, raise a garden or something. Relaxation to me. People can't understand that. It also is instructions for the kids.
Okay.
Now, if you don't show them that you can do so much and that the Lord or some other power, whatever you want to think the power is the basis for that.
Mm-hmm.
There again, Hoppy's influence with the chard that he used, the different mulches and things like that, the coffee ground episode, And people don't want to take the time to investigate these things a little bit. And as far as the science is concerned, oh, my God, I've spent lots of years learning my trade, and I'm not going to let you know any, I give you any answers unless you pay me the $150 or $200 a day. I was on a job which I abandoned as a consultant. At $150 a day in expenses. And, you know, to turn that down, foolish in a way. But I just couldn't take the baloney that
That's
goes
right.
along with it.
And I don't think
nobody's going to pay any attention to you.
So much money is wasted in that.
Oh, it's terrible. But I don't know whether whether you understand what I'm talking about exactly or not, but all these things is part of living, part of life. But to me, being able to prove to myself and make things work is more important than to listening to some chap in a university or somewhere try to...
Well, isn't that essentially just taking responsibility for your life?
Let's put it another way. A lot of people have said, well, I don't know what I'm doing here. And that, I think, is a question that everybody should ask themselves and try to find an answer to, you see. Well, I was at a job out at the university. We just moved into a new building. And the campus engineer, now, people don't understand about maintenance. In order for a student to learn something, thing conditions have to be pretty good. You can't have a flickering light over your head or a squeaking chair or something. And the teacher, in order to teach good, has got to have certain conditions right. Nobody pays any attention to that. But that is a foundation that you've got to have in order to teach other people. And that was what I was interested in.
What years did you work at?
Well, I went out there. They had the problem with when they started enlarging just before Patty come, or before just before Dr. Wood showed up.
But what year was that?
1959. Okay. They wanted to know if I would come out and set up a paint shop for them. And, you know, do a little work. So I said, well, okay, I'll 3 or 4 months. And then we extended it to 6 months. And it ended up 13 and a half years. I retired just a month or so before Wood retired from out there. And I went from after getting the paint shop going and getting people sitting around and waiting, hoping that things would break down so that they could get in overtime. And doing a little research, he found out that there was more overtime being paid than, like plumbers, for instance, than there was in, and electricians and so on, than there was in the normal base pay, which was good pay at that time. I never paid as the money end of it, as long as you're busy, the actual amount of money you get doesn't really make too much difference, because you'd have a million and it wouldn't do you a damn bit of good unless you had earned it, you see. Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that. Mm-hmm. Anybody can go out and make money if they wanted to be a little loose. Mm-hmm. Very prominent banker downtown. He's kind of retired. He's got a big place down in Florida now where he's putting most of his money. Same with my brother and I. When we together, he's had a lot of property around him. And he says, if you boys will let me manage it, I'll make you millionaires in a year. But I mean, this is what could be done.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very sound, his formula. But he would manage it, he'd also make another million. Didn't need it, but I just not interested. And we've got more than we can use between us, Betty and I.
You have family, and you know.
But it hasn't always been like that, you know. A lot of time when the dime, I was caught in 1934 in Seattle, I had gone out to buy a bunch of supplies and got everything ready to go on the ship, and the strike was pulled down there. And that was our only transportation, you know, once a week ship. And I was there over 4 months.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
And towards the end, why, I was
pretty skinny.
Getting desperate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I had a good time and all that. Worried about what was going on here. And I came north on a Navy ship, and that was just a, kind of a odd sort of thing. I don't let civilians go on Navy ships.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, very odd. There was a flyer by the name of Frank Dorbent, and he was kind of a World War I type flyer, you know. He always had a sash around his neck and all that.
Yeah.
And he was bringing a tri-motored Ford, I think it was, to Fairbanks. Well, when you want to get home, why, everybody that had anything to do with Alaska knew what anybody else was going on. And so I got a call from, not from him, but chap that was going as a mechanic for him, and says, we're going to leave in a couple of days, and we're going to fly to Fairbanks. You want to go along, or do you know of anybody else who wants to ride along? Good, cheap transportation, be a good trip. And for some reason or other, I said, well, I'd like to go, but I'll pass the word around. And I really wanted to go, but I didn't, because I only got a little ways out in the Canadian area there, about, 'way the other side of Whitehorse. And they had the land, and they was, I beat them home. I went home long before they ever got
it. Is that right? That what happened to
you? Yeah. So you're kind of directed along these things. And a lot of people call it a hunch, perhaps. But you're directed.
Yeah,
you know,
it doesn't matter what you call it. It's just the thing to...
Then there was a friend who was coming up to go to Kodiak on a fishing boat. And my gosh, a fishing boat is nice here for 3 or 4 days, and then it gets kind of bad. And one of them that was coming was an accordion player. And I had a friend who was an accordion player. He played an orchestra that I had for a little while. And so he wanted me to come along with him. And I passed him in Petersburg.
Oh, gosh. Another one.
Oh, it was a fine bunch, but they were regular fishermen. They got in the damn party there in Petersburg, and they wasn't going to leave until everybody was flat broke, you know. But there was only five people on that boat, and there was plenty of room. There was room for eight, you know. But you just, I think you're directed. Well, there was an announcement. We happened to be talking with some people that I stayed with a couple of days there that were interested. Some of the relatives here in Fairbanks that stayed with us, and visiting with them for a few days. And radio was on, and here was an announcement that president was going to authorize a ship to go to Alaska to carry the mail during this strike.
Oh.
And it clicked just like that. So I went to the phone and tried to find out and couldn't find out anything, but it was Navy ship would be in Bremerton. So I went downtown and got a float plane. I was not going to wait for any ferry, and I didn't know about the ferry runs anyway and whether they stopped there. And so he run me right over to the gate at Bremerton Navy Yards. And I told him what I wanted, and he said he'd come back and pick me up on such and such a call. And a terrible ship. One that was old, the old original flying boats. And boy, it's rough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have come to Fairbanks, or to Juneau on that same ship if I'd wanted to. And I didn't do it. No need then, anyway. But lo and behold, here come a jeep up to the gate, and the captain of a minesweeper USS Partridge, which was, had a great history and built in World War I, and the chief bosun on that ship commanded that ship in the North Sea during World War I, minesweeper. Nice ship to travel on. They're about as wide as they are long, you know, and about 135, 40 personnel, and close quarters, you know, real inadequate as far as feel like putting a whole family in a little room like that, you know.
Yeah.
But,
you really have to have a
but it was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I explained, I said, well, I'm stuck, and I had all this stuff there in the dock to come north. Well, most of it was, I couldn't have touched it until the strike would be settled anyway. It's just tied up.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of stuff is no good, like produce and things like that, you know. Oh, I took a terrible loss. Nothing I could do about it, nothing you could do, and there was no use suing or anything,
mm-mm,
because you wouldn't get the first base. But he said, well, what we have to do is to go over and talk with the commandant. And the commandant was also the commandant of 13th Naval District there in Bremerton, covered all of Alaska, too. And so he took me over, and commandant of the Admiral's aide, you tell him what it is, and so he showed me, and something different to have an Alaskan show up, I think. And especially not knowing who you are, you know. But as it happened, my brother and I had this property down there where Wainwright is now, and we had a float plane deal where people could go, Wien and Pan American and Pacific International, and all those. Well, we put it in for Pacific International, Howard Hughes layout.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
And so that was the basis of my request to
that they could land, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I did have equipment for that, for that, you know, signal devices and one thing or another for landing. It was used not only in the summertime, but when it was foggy down at Weeks Field there where the high school is, you know, why they'd land out there on the river because they had a good approach. And so that was the basis. And the only thing I could think of, but it was the correct thing, and it was legitimate in a way. So he said, well, I have no authority to let a civilian on the ship. But you'd have to, he told the senior lieutenant, who was the commander of this ship, said, you have Sparks, meaning a radio man, get a hold of the Secretary of the Navy, and if he says yes, why, that's all right. Well, in the matter, he says, thank you, sir. And the admiral says, good luck, and that was it. Carry on. Well, we went over to the Sparks layout and took a few minutes for him to figure out a request to Secretary of Navy Swanson. And Swanson was not in his office. It was too late then. It was time difference, you know. And we had a discussion last night about a jet lag. I'm just thinking about Smithy Smith's cartoon about little Jughead coming to go home. They wondered what was wrong, and he had jet lag.
Oh, yeah.
But silly things like that, you know, shouldn't keep in your mind,
yeah.
But we had a little fun over last night. And Japanese girl had a little problem in flying this way, and if she'd been flying the other way, she wouldn't have jet lag, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it is important. So about midnight that night, and they were going to sail right now, you know, just a matter of a day or so. And so about mid that night, the Lieutenant Isquith, the captain of the ship, called up and says, we've got the telegram here from the Secretary of Navy and says you're entitled to go, and it'll cost you fees for the wardroom, $1.50 a day. Well, that hit me just right. $10.50, you know.
So about all you had left?
Well, geez, not, I had enough to buy some good whiskey, Scotch, 15-year-old Mackenzie and Stewart's Royal Club, and it just come on the market there. And by golly, I've got several bottles there, enough to buy a part of a case, and that was a donation in addition. And that stuck fine because all they had was alcohol, and they made gin by putting distilled water and alcohol, green alcohol, and oil of juniper in it, and you have gin. That's all gin is, you know. But it's called bathtub gin.
Yeah.
And it's pretty terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you mix something good with it. I've never been much on drinking.
No, I'm not.
I'm waste of time. I'm not against it. Much as it is. We've always had it ever since I can remember in the house, and it was called for medicinal purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think that's important. If you deny somebody, then you got to have it, you know.
Yeah. But if you just have it hanging around, they see
and if you use your, and now this is, use it intelligently.
Mm-hmm.
If you're cold, have a whisper of it, a little sugar and hot water.
Mm-hmm.
But it's no difference in drinking something else, you know. Well, anyway, that's the situation. So we had a beautiful cruise. Now, the minesweeper, we hit they had jobs to do. We had a Lieutenant Hunter who collected a dollar from each of the ports that the Navy owned in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Which was very interesting, a very fine chap. I like him very much. And we had, I forget all the names of them, but there was four lieutenants, and captain was a senior lieutenant with one exception, the executive officer, and who happened to be Senior Lieutenant Massey of the Honolulu Scramble. Did you ever remember of that?
No.
Well, there was a battle wagon in Honolulu, and Massey was Josephus Daniels' kin down in South Carolina or North Carolina, somewhere down there. So he got an appointment to be a naval officer, and he was executive officer on this battleship that was anchored in Hawaii and is married to a very prominent gal from one of the old families down in South Carolina, and who was kin to Josephus Daniels, Roosevelt's boss during World War I, under Roosevelt, or under, you know who I mean, the teacher, Wilson, all right. And she got into a little trouble with a Hawaiian guy down there, and he took out his gun and killed him. And, of course, they immediately transferred him out of Hawaii because it was not a very legitimate killing.
No, also.
And,
of course, in those days, too, you know, the
things were different.
Yes, it was, you see, and Strictly from Jubal, from that count, that, I could see a whole different framework. And then,
So, this ship that he was on, and I forget the battle wagon, it was sunk, by the way, in World War II, was going back to Hawaii, and he's in the Navy. When you got a rating, unless you're convicted or given a trial for Section 8 or something, they can't withhold that particular position. And being an executive officer on a ship is very important. So they made him executive officer on this Partridge. And he was my roommate coming to Alaska.
He
got along very fine with him, but he was a damn nut.
Apparently, I
crazy as hell. One of the jobs he had was calibrating all of the direction-finding lighthouses. Was interesting, but very tedious because you're going around these lighthouses for hours and hours and hours, and what are you going to do in the meantime? Well, I happen to know somebody in each of the towns in Alaska. I knew the caretakers there at Port Elphet and near the dividing line between Canada, Mount St. Elias area, between Canada and Alaska. So I said, well, if you want to put the barge overboard, why, we'll go over and visit. And went over and played a game of bridge and